It's 8:14. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, as we have reported, the Wasatch County Council last week voted to authorize 100-foot easements on several roads, some of them not platted, that go right through the 1,350 acres of open space that Park City residents purchased last year for $38 million. On the phone to explain why the county council did that and a little bit about the authority they have when it comes to private property, I have Wasatch County Manager Mike Davis. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Leslie.
This was an agenda item on the county council's agenda. It was briefly discussed. The council then moved into closed session, then came out and to take the vote that authorized these easements. I guess, first of all, is why?
The first issue is that Park City has invited us as a stakeholder to meetings to discuss the formation of the conservation easement on the property and certainly the management of the property. We've expressed concern in those meetings that public access should be determined before that is done, and they've not agreed with us, and we understand that, but we are we do have jurisdiction over the area and feel that what roads are there. And the problem has been that we haven't been able to have those discussions. And so I think the impetus from the council, and I'm just speaking from my interpretation of that, is that they really need to be at the table to have this discussion before the conservation easement is put in place. And so by not having all of the information necessary yet, they authorized, our county council authorized, the county attorney and myself to gather the information together, which we have been doing, on roads in that area that may have public benefit or been used for more than 10 years by the public, which the state code allows, and present those to them, which we will be doing today. It doesn't mean that we'll be a lawsuit. It means that the county council is going to take that under advisement, and they've authorized us to look at that. So, and I might have just one point of clarification. The only 100-foot easement is on the Pine Canyon Road, which is a deeded easement to Wasatch County. Wasatch County purchased that easement back in 1959, and it is a 100-foot easement. And simply what we were doing was reiterating that it is 100-foot, which we don't believe has been taken into consideration during the conservation easement process.
Okay, so it's my understanding we're talking about four roads that really, I think that may have just started as kind of goat trails. I mean, it was the closest way to get from point A to point B, really without regard to whose property was being crossed. Is that accurate?
You know, I can't speak to the nature of how the road started. They've been there longer than I've been here. The subdivision's been there over 50 years, and there's roads all, you know, we have these types of situations all over the county. We've had this situation before, and we've had to claim the roads, and we have litigated roads, and when there's public involved and public access, if it's private property and the private property owners protect that access and limit access and post it and so forth, usually those are limited where there's been public access granted. And the law states if it's over 10 years of continuous use, it becomes public. And so we're just conforming with what those statutes are. We're looking at them. We're certainly not trying to make public roads everywhere. That's not the case. But we need the discussion. Are they emergency accesses? Are they no accesses? Are they winter accesses? What type of accesses are these roads that are claimed? And it may come down to they're no access. But that discussion, nobody's been willing to have the discussion yet, so the county council had to take some action.
Well, just because people have used the roads, and now you say they are considered roads by use, I mean, just because it's been a free-for-all, people driving wherever they wanted to for the last 50 years, does that make it right?
You know, you'd have to ask the legislature that. They're the ones that make the state code.
Again, there were roads platted for the Pine Canyon and Brighton Estates development more than 50 years ago. Why not just stick to those roads?
Certainly those roads are roads as well, but public roads are not limited to ones that are platted. The Guardsman Pass Road, which back in the 30s was created, was not a platted road. It was not a dedicated road. And eventually the state took it as a state road, and then the state turned it over to the county. So roads over the, you know, the decades have been created through use, and certainly, you know, there could be discussion and objection to it, and often these are litigated, and the courts then decide, okay, is it really to the benefit of the public or not? We're not certainly looking to go to litigation by any means, but we want to be having the discussion, are these roads essential to the public, and more particularly to emergency accesses and other things up in that area? So there are other property owners besides Brighton Estates in the area. There's lots of private property up there. So all of these considerations are being looked at.
Yeah, I guess it's like, why didn't Wasatch County do something about this years ago? I mean, you knew it was an issue. I mean, it was, again, just basically a free-for-all. You just didn't want to rock the boat?
Roads, unless the roads are dedicated, which we did ask Park City if we could discuss the dedication of the Guardsman Road, Empire Pass Road, and they said no, we could not discuss that. And so, once again, because we couldn't have a discussion, we had to do some things. So most roads, even in neighborhoods, property lines go to the center of roads, and they're simply dedicated through use, and they become a public easement. And so unless they're dedicated through right-of-way, there is no deed or formal thing with that. We do have a formal deed on the Pine Canyon Road, but other than that, we don't have any formal deeds up in that area.
Well, and as you mentioned, Wasatch County paid the property owners for that Pine Canyon Road some 50 years ago. Park City residents spent $38 million for that acreage up there, and I'm guessing if we added up all of that acreage of that those unplatted roads take up, it's got to be worth something. I guess, will you have to pay city property owners as well?
If they're public roads through use, we don't. If we condemn the property, if we went through a condemnation process, an eminent domain process, we would have to pay for the road. We're not proposing that at all.
So have you heard from city officials? And is Wasatch County bracing for a lawsuit?
I know that the city officials have reached out. I know the city attorney reached out and scheduled a meeting with the county attorney. They did meet this week. I do know that I was asked for a phone number for our council chair, that the mayor wanted to reach out to the council chair. Neither discussions I'm privy to, so I don't know what was discussed at this point.
So talk to me a little bit about the jurisdiction that you have on Guardsman's Pass Road. You basically have jurisdiction from where it meets, where Guardsman's meets Pine Canyon Road, there at that hairpin turn, and then basically to the gate that is set up every winter and locked that is within city limits?
No. We only have jurisdiction to the county line. And so Empire Pass, the road that would go from Empire Pass down to the junction with Pine Canyon Road and up to Guardsman Pass, that road, which was a former state road, and is a state road still on the Park City side and on the Big Cottonwood Canyon side, it's still a state road. But that little piece in between was given to the county about 20 years ago from the state. There was some exchanges that took place at the time regarding when the Jordanelle Dam was built and the new Highway 32 was constructed from the River Road access that goes up into Francis. That road was a new road that was constructed, and there were some swaps made of roads. It's before my time as county manager, but so I wasn't involved in that. But my understanding is the state basically gave the road to the county.
All right. And then, as you mentioned, those easements there near the Y intersection, just 100-foot easements, and this is basically to provide some, basically to make a parking lot?
No, the 100-foot easement acquired in 1959, I don't know that they had any anticipation of a parking lot. Easements were generally given, they could vary anywhere from 66 feet to 150 feet, depending on the use. For instance, the old Highway 40 that goes down below the dam used to go up where Jordanelle is. The state gave us that easement. That's a 150-foot easement through there. So it just depends on what the state had or what they used at the time, and we tried to match them. Easements are used for a lot of reasons, mostly for utility use and access. We would never have any anticipation of a road that would be anywhere near something like that. But in many cases, particularly in mountain areas, those easements are required because of the slopes adjacent to the roads. And so to have a shoulder on the road, you have to protect the road. And so you go out, but as you go out, you also maybe go up or down. And so that can take up a lot of area. And so those 100-foot easements are often in place to help the safety integrity of the road, even though the road may only be 30 feet wide.
So the county won't be providing parking areas then for those who can't get to their homes during the winter months?
We do have an agreement in place that's been in place for many years with the Brighton Estates residents that they can park on the easement. They may not park on the private property to which the easements are adjacent. And so that's been in place for several years. If there were another place provided for parking, certainly we could take that out of there. That's not a problem. And there has been discussion that that might be a possibility, that we could get some parking area for them somewhere. But that property all through there is private, and so the only property we have control over is the right-of-way itself. And so we did offer that to them that during wintertime they could park there.
Yeah, and we have heard that some of that parking there happening near the Y intersection then, again, is spilling over onto private property. You know, I don't have a trailer, but if I did, I wouldn't get to park it on your front lawn. So why are these people been allowed to do that?
You know, we've never been called up there on that issue. I understand that during this last winter there were some pictures taken, things done, but we have never been notified by the property owner prior to right now that this was even happening. And so we can't take care of what we don't know.
Yeah, and you have said that this is not an adversarial action. It's just you need to make some kind of stakeholder positions so that you can ensure that you can have access. Why was that important that it was done before the conservation easement went into effect?
It's our feeling that once the conservation easement is in place, it very much limits the ability to discuss this. Throughout the discussions with the stakeholders, it's been made very clear by Park City that they felt that what was being done there were uses and not access. And so uses could imply that they had no rights at all of access through those areas, which we haven't determined yet and we haven't had the discussions on yet. So we felt that was important to get those discussions done and to have those discussions before those conservation easements are put in place that would limit any uses. And let's just get it resolved and move on. We're excited for the conservation easement. We think it's a great thing. But we do feel as responsibility of jurisdiction up there that we do need to clarify some of these items first.
Yeah. Now, does Wasatch County plow Pine Canyon Road in the winter?
No, we do not.
So the only access to Brighton Estates is through Park City
In the winter? Yeah, that is if they plow that. And that access was granted by UDOT on the Park City side to the Brighton Estates landowners many years ago, and it essentially, because prior to that, that road has always been closed seasonally for forever, and we supported that. UDOT on the Park City side granted the owners ability to plow that road, and we were forced, because they got to the property, the county line, we were forced to allow them to plow for a certain area. So we just allowed them down to the Y intersection. We said that's the limit of what we'll allow, the UDOT permission is what precipitated that. So, and both Park City and Wasatch County have worked together to try and mitigate any negative things on that. It's been difficult because Park City doesn't have jurisdiction of the road on their side. It's through UDOT. And so that's been a kind of a delicate balance, and we've tried to work real well with that. But with the proposed changes of eliminating the parking down at the Y and other things, we just need to work through all of these questions so that we can have some answers for everybody. The Brighton Estates people are still residents of our county, and they are still property owners and taxpayers of our county, so as well as Park City owns property in our county now. So we've got to try to work together on this to solve all these issues.
Real quickly, I wanted to ask you about a couple of other issues. Where do things stand with the Prost property and the application to change the zoning there from one unit per 20 acres to one unit per five?
My understanding was there was going to be another referendum on that zoning change. There was a referendum on the change of the county plan, general plan. That referendum failed. They didn't get the signatures, and so they have put in for another referendum, so they are now gathering signatures, and if they gather the signatures in the appropriate amount of time, then that issue would go to the ballot. If it doesn't, the referendum would fail, and the action of the council would then proceed.
All right. And then what are the details with regard to the $35 million county bond issuance for the expansion of the IHC hospital?
What that is we've done this previously. When IHC issues a general bond, and it could be for several counties, and this one is as well, they'll have a county from which they enter or they apply for the bond. In this case, it was Utah County. And because they're doing expansion on their facilities in Utah County, they're also doing expansion in Wasatch County and I think Washington County. And so even though we're not sponsoring the bond, we don't have any obligation of the bond, it is a revenue bond, and so the bond is based solely on the revenue that we receive. It's not a tax payer type of a bond. But because they are going to spend some of that money, the $35 million in Wasatch County, they have to have a public hearing, and it has to be held in a council meeting. So, and we have done this previously on the previous expansions of the hospital. We have done the same thing, but there is no financial obligation of the taxpayers of Wasatch County for this. It will all be through the revenue that is received, that IHC receives through their services.
Okay. Does it impact the county's bond rating at all by doing this?
It does not, nor does it impact its capacity. Often when counties get into bond agreements, they have caps, limits of how much the county overall is able to bond for. And so if you have little increments of bonds, it can take away from that capacity. This does not affect our capacity, and this does not affect our bond rating at all.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention, Mike?
No. We do have a couple wildfires already this season, and so we're preparing for that as the public comes into our area. We're looking forward to some of the other things we're working with. We understand the Yellowstone television series is starting, and that's been filmed in both of our areas, in Park City and in Wasatch County. So we've got a lot of good things going on. We're just happy to have summer here.
Okay. Mike, thanks for your time this morning.
Leslie, thank you.
That's Mike Davis, the manager of Wasatch County. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission last night got its first look at the proposed market at Silver Creek and seemed to like what they saw in the studio. I have the owner-developer of the marketplace at Silver Creek, Henry Sig. Good morning.
Hi, Leslie.
So tell us just a little bit more about the property, where it is, how much you have there, and what the existing zoning is on it.
Yeah, we have a total of approximately 20 acres on two parcels located on Silver Creek Drive. The first parcel is right at the roundabout between, I would say, Home Depot and the Restore. And the second parcel is at the intersection of the Promontory Road right next to the Questar building.
So are they contiguous then?
They're not contiguous. Mm-hmm. It's a four-acre parcel and a 15-acre parcel.
Okay, so what would go on the four-acre parcel?
We're proposing a mixed-use village center type of development that encompasses retail and housing, structured parking. The four-acre parcel has an office retail building, the potential for a drive-through bank, and two residential buildings.
Okay. And how many residential units would go there?
The total, you know, it's a little bit of a moving target in terms of how many units because the sizes haven't been defined yet, and final working drawings. We're in a conceptual stage right now, but our anticipation is that we would have somewhere between 140 and 170 total units on the two parcels.
Yeah. So then, what's proposed for the 16-acre? Just residential?
No, that parcel has a structured parking garage. It has residential units. We're seeking an entitlement for a larger type of use there. Potentially a grocery store is the ideal target. We have, you know, a coffee area, regular inline retail, restaurants. We're trying to create a streetscape on Silver Creek Drive where it would be like bistro dining outside, patio dining, and, you know, hike and bike paths that are off of the street.
Yeah. Does it also front the frontage road there then?
It does. Mm-hmm. The parcel goes up to what I would call the second entry to the Home Depot, coming off of the old Highway 40 road there.
And is that what that's called, the frontage road or Highway 40?
I call it old Highway 40. Mm-hmm. That's what I've referred to.
The grocery store that you talk about is, I think, proposed to be about 40,000 square feet. We've kind of heard some names throw out. Do you have a contract with anybody at this point? Or
we don't. And as I explained to the commission last night, is in order to get the grocery stores or the potential tenancy there, you need to have validity. And, you know, to be a what-if project is different from being a project that is currently under entitlement or entitled. And that's the point that the tenants like to start speaking to you, because we're looking to push the envelope a little bit on the maximum permitted retail use, which is currently stated at 20,000 feet in the community commercial zone.
In terms of just one
single
structure.
User, yeah.
Right.
And the grocery stores, they have, you know, formats for success and size requirements that are very specific. And although they're trending downward in square footage, they're a little bit more than the 20,000 foot that the current code allows.
And I think we heard last night that Smith's wouldn't go into a space smaller than 65,000 square feet.
That's correct. In our conversations, initial conversations with them, that was kind of their building footprint. So... Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but Trader Joe's are often very small with no parking. There's some smaller Harmon's markets, Immigration Market-like.
Honeybee, mm-hmm. Sprouts, Trader Joe's, correctly stated,
yeah.
Harmon's.
Commissioner B. Peck worried that the grocery stores that were kind of thrown out tend to be the higher-end, pricier stores, and she wanted to know how that would fit into this idea of your affordable living working area.
Well, everybody likes $2 Chuck or $3 Chuck.
Except that we can't get it here. But.
But we can't get it. But at the end of the day, you know, it was interesting. Someone in the audience made a comment to me that the folks at Landmark and some of the developments out by the outlet stores, they're all shopping at Whole Foods. So, you know, I think it's a convenience factor as much as it is a cost factor.
So that, again, that you would have to get that decision before you start knocking on doors then in terms of...
We've had preliminary conversations with folks, but it's always the same response. There's a little bit of, the tenants are a little gun-shy about getting an entitlement up here because they know how difficult it is and how rigid the codes are.
Yeah. In terms of the affordability, I mean, of the 140, 160 units, I mean, what are we talking about? Market units, or some of those having to be affordable just due to the code?
Yeah, one of the things that you hear around town is the notion of social parity. And so we're proposing to maintain all of our affordable housing units, all of our market workforce housing units, and then the full retail market units in the same complex. So the way I described it last night was that the same people from any type of unit will be riding the same elevator.
Yeah. So how many of those 160 would be considered affordable?
We've done a sort of back of napkin calculation, and, you know, we defer to the Planning Commission to tell us what the final requirement is based on square footage of the retail uses and the office uses. But we anticipate we'll have somewhere around 80 units between affordable and workforce housing.
All right. Also, you're proposing, I think, an 800-seat amphitheater along Silver Creek Drive?
Yeah. You know, this whole thing came about in terms of creating some connectivity to the Gilmore parcel, creating a civic attribute to our site. And there's surprisingly really good contour to the south of our property that would lend itself to an amphitheater that on our property alone could accommodate 800 seats, but with some cooperation from the county on basically the corner of the Gilmore piece, we could expand that to 1,800 seats. And as you know, there are many nonprofits out there and organizations that currently kind of are looking for a home.
Yeah, and certainly it's not your problem to solve, but that little roundabout, I mean, with Silver Creek Village, another 1,300 units also using that. I mean, do we need to figure out a different intersection there?
Well, I'm not sure if it's an intersection question. We propose a roundabout at the Promontory Road as well. And based on the discussions last night, we'll start looking at some what I might call a bypass road. That, you know, if we could work, you know, part of the issue there is not created only by us. It's created by the acceptance of the Silver Creek Village Center. We designed the roundabout that's there. Our company designed it with Horrocks Engineering, presented it to the county, and they ended up building it. And, you know, part of that discussion has to do with whose responsibility is the traffic. It can't only be our burden.
Right. Planning Commissioner B. Peckett asked to see an overlay of the entire area of the Home Depot, the Restore, the old Highway 40 commercial zone. I mean, what would that do? What is she looking for there?
I think she wants to see what kind of zoning consistencies are there. Right now, our property is in the community commercial zone. I know that there's some agricultural lands around as you go out the old Highway 40. But I think just to get a better understanding of, you know, the existing zoning there per the permitted uses that you could have there and the potential for what type of application process could exist there. I mean, because you could do everything from the MPD to you know, the general plan amendment, designate as town center, and go through a special planned area to attain what our proposal is seeking.
So what's next?
Well, the waiting game. Where the commission has asked the planning department to make this overlay presentation, and I think they're going to discuss the vehicle for entitlement. I mean, how do we get to where we want to be? I mean, admittedly, we're seeking some exceptions to the height, some exceptions to the size of a single retail user. And I think the commission needs to get their arms around how can we make this happen.
Okay. I need to leave it there. Henry, thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks, Leslie. Have a good one.
That's Henry Sigg with the Marketplace at Silver Creek. You're listening to the Local News Hour at KEEP. Well, the Summit County Council recently approved a county mental health and substance abuse area plan and just came off a very well-attended Mental Health Month with a number of events, films, and panels being put on by Connect Summit County as well as the County Mental Health Alliance. In the studio to discuss the work of the Alliance over the last 6 months and what's ahead, I have Summit County Health Department Mental Health and Substance Abuse Coordinator Aaron Newman. Good morning.
Morning.
So let's just talk a little bit about that. I mean, the Alliance formed about 6 months ago to do what specifically?
Well, the Alliance really formed before that. When I came on board last April, and it was brought about by as we've talked before, the unfortunate events at Treasure Mountain High School, but then also several different community agencies realizing they needed to work together to address these issues. 6 months ago, we actually began implementation of the strategic plan, and which took about 6 months to work with community partners to find input, identify our five strategic goals, come up with outcomes, objectives, means for achieving those. And those were approved by the county council in November of last year. So the beginning of phase one was January 1st. And we've divided the strategic plan into several different phases lasting 6 months to really kind of make sure that they're in swallowable amounts, that we can lay foundational work, make everything sustainable, and move forward in what we're trying to accomplish.
So what was it that you did this first 6 months then?
A lot. It was kind of when I was writing the staff report and sitting back and looking, it kind of caught me off guard in just the amount of work that was done by over 200 people in the community, our volunteers, our partner organizations. Some of the big successes that we've had has been in, we're excited that next week we're rolling out our Hope Elevated series. It's a suicide prevention program that deals not only with the prevention, but postvention and intervention for people to learn those skills on how to deal with individuals at different stages of suicide ideation. The program we've worked with the National Health Ministry of Scotland to create, their program is called Choose Life, and it's an international model for communities, specifically rural communities, on how they can address suicide. It's used by 42 different countries worldwide as their national model. The World Health Organization identifies as the most successful suicide prevention program that any community could use. So we've enjoyed working and developing that.
So why is that, though? I mean, what is it that they do? Because you'd also been using that QPR,
and QPR is actually a big part of the Choose Life program, or Hope Elevated, as we're calling it here in Summit County. And it's all about how do you educate people to recognize the signs of suicide in someone, and then how do you then work with an individual, not only to just talk to them and to find out what is the level of suicide ideation, are they moving into action, and then to connect them with help. What we've been really excited about with this, we've been doing QPR for a while in the community, hitting up the schools, doing different organizations. Park City Municipal has had the health department come in and provide QPR training to their staff. The Summit County is also currently in the process of training all of their staff in QPR. But we wanted to hit those other people that you don't necessarily think about. So who are those individuals that have that daily or weekly interaction with the same people and get them trained? So we're reaching out to all the physical therapists, because everyone around here probably has their favorite one on speed dial that you're always going to go and see, so they can understand and see the signs of someone who may be in need for those conversations. But then also we'll be reaching out to the different supermarkets and training the cashiers. These are also, we all know our favorite cashiers by name in this town, and having them just notice, you know, something wasn't quite right with Aaron today. I wonder what it is. I'm going to ask some questions next time, and really make this something that empowers the community to start recognizing the signs and not be afraid to ask those hard questions. We just finished editing our first document. It's about a 20-page little booklet all on having those difficult conversations. So how do you, as the average citizen, how do you as a parent, how do you as a coworker, approach someone and start saying, you know what, I have these concerns, I'm just here to listen. And then if you feel you need to engage in those QPR skills that you learn, you can do that.
Yeah. And I think what we've kind of learned over the last couple of weeks with the two high profile suicides is that people with depression, they don't reach out.
No. And when we look at the latest data, so this past month, a lot of data has been coming out about suicide. Over 54% of the individuals who committed suicide last year did not have a mental illness and had no previous signs of depression or that they were suicidal. For most of the families, it came as a shock to them, according to the data. And it's an important issue. You can never really say that there's good happening when we look at suicide data. Utah is making some strides. We've moved from number 3 in the nation down to number 5 over the past 4 years. We as a county now have dropped from the 7th highest rate of suicide in the state of Utah to the 8th place. So it's only one step, but we're moving in the right direction with that.
Okay. So what else is the Alliance then working on?
We're really excited in that our CTC program is just incredible, what the work they're doing and the committee members. We had a phone meeting, Mary Krista did, with our representatives from University of Washington, which is the home base for communities that care. And we are easily 2 to 3 years ahead of where most coalitions are in terms of the community support in identifying what are our risk factors, what are our protective factors. And they're in the process right now of selecting what are the programs that we'll be implementing in the schools, and more importantly, for parents to learn about mental illness and substance abuse.
All right. And any other program that you wanted to highlight?
I think one of the other ones that we're really excited about is Lynn Rutan has been from Connect, has really been working to bring a clubhouse to Park City. A clubhouse is part of an organization called Clubhouse International, and it's designed to be a facility for those with a diagnosed mental illness or substance abuse disorder to really learn life skills, to give them a skill set that they can leave after amount of time and be in the workforce. It's designed to help them learn those skills firsthand. So we're very excited in that the Christian Center has agreed to be part of our process with this and to host the clubhouse in their wonderful new facility. We're currently working with them to really see what's that going to look like in terms of programs. But that right there is a huge hurdle for most programs.
So this isn't kind of an overnight facility. It's just kind of like a day camp, huh? A day
Correct.
Clubhouse.
It's run by the participants. So they learn the skills of the bookkeeping. They learn how do they – generally a lot of these have food preparation in them. So how do they go about what's safe food handling? They also have the opportunity to partner. We're working with Salt Lake Community College. If they don't have a GED or at least an associate's degree, that they can have the opportunity through the skills they're learning to gain those degrees as well.
So when do you expect to see that clubhouse start up?
Hopefully, we're actually having an informational meeting on the 20th at 10 o'clock at the health department. And to really talk about, we're Skyping in a few people from the national organization to talk about a startup committee to get this going. Our goal would be by this time next year, we'll have had at least a small group going through, maybe meeting two to three times a week, seeing if we have capacity, seeing where we're at, what are the costs going to be. Because right now there's a lot of grants to get this going from the national organization, as well as Medicaid dollars can go towards this.
All right. Lots of good work going on. Yeah. All right, Aaron, hey, thanks for
Thank you, Leslie. Your
time this morning. Aaron Newman, again, Summit County Health and Substance Abuse Director. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Well, as we've reported, Powder Corp founder and chairman John Cumming has stepped down as CEO, and he has named Wade Martin and Justin Sibley to serve as co-presidents. Both of them join me now in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Wade, let's just start with you. You've been with, Powder Enterprises for 5 years or so?
I have. I came to Powder about 5 years ago.
Okay. And maybe you can just explain what Powder is and Powder Enterprises are.
Yeah, well, Powder Enterprises was a division we created about 5 years ago, really to help diversify the powder business. And so we got into more events and media and things like that. And then that role evolved to becoming the chief revenue officer a few years ago. And then today's move.
Okay. And then, Justin, you've been with Powder as kind of the financial guy?
Yes, I've been the CFO now for just over 4 years.
Okay. So I'm guessing with the two of you now in charge, we have equal authority here?
Yes.
How challenging is it to not know where the buck stops, though? Does it stop with you or does it stop with you?
Well, we're only on day two, but we haven't had that many issues yet. Justin and I have been working together for 4 or 5 years now. We work really well. Our strengths are pretty complementary. The areas that we oversee are pretty discreet, and so we're not really worried about it. I think, mostly excited. We've got a lot to do and a lot going on, and I think having both of us in charge really gives us more scope and more ability to get after all the things we want to do.
Well, tell us a little bit about what Powder does, because I think most of us just thought of it as the former owner of Park City Mountain Resort, but it's a lot more than that.
Yes, it is. In addition to Park City that we used to own, we have 9 other mountain properties and 5 action sports facilities across the U.S. and Latin America.
And we got into the events business a few years ago. We have an outside holding and outside television that's part of the overall group that we manage. And so Powder's become a lot more than a ski resort holding company, although that continues to be a big part of the business.
Okay. And so in terms of what you're responsible for, Wade, what's that?
Justin and I share the responsibilities, but really I focus more on the organic growth side of the business and focus on how are we reaching our consumers, how are we elevating the experience for our consumers. And Justin and I set the strategy together and bring that to execute all that.
All right, and you're still going to make sure that he's got the money to do it?
Yeah, with that being my background, of course, I'll continue to keep an eye on those things and then also evaluate other business opportunities that we might have to bring the adventure lifestyle to even more enthusiasts.
Yeah, and that's something I think Hervig Demschar has done with John, basically looking for those other assets. Does he remain in that?
He is. Hervig reports to me, and we'll continue that work.
Okay, and then in terms of Tim Bremwall, another local, he also was promoted, basically doing the same thing, but now on
Yes, for the last 3 years, Tim was the chief operating officer of Powder Resorts, and now he's been promoted to being the chief operating officer of Powder overall, as we're streamlining the operations and really integrating the resort and the camp business.
All right. How many employees are there within Powder, and including Powder Enterprises?
So depending on the time of the year, it's as high as about 8,000.
Wow, because there are all of the workers at each of those 9 resorts, huh?
Correct.
Hmm. All right. How many do you have based here in Park City, the headquarters?
Here in Park City, we have 30.
All right. All right. And then let's talk a little bit about Woodward Gargosa, because that's one of the five, or is that going to be the sixth?
This will be the sixth.
Okay. An action sports camp that has received approvals from Summit County. Where do things stand there?
So we've worked diligently with the community over the last couple of years to put together a plan that we think will satisfy everyone's needs, and we're looking forward to breaking ground here in the next couple of months and hopefully being open summer of 2019.
Okay, and can you just kind of give us a brief overview of what's going to be built there?
Well, this Woodward will be the first of its kind. You know, we have summer camps with Woodward. We have what we call our mountain centers at Copper Mountain and at Tahoe. And Woodward Park City is really going to bring all of those things together in that it'll be a mini mountain resort with a lot of terrain-based teaching and parks. But it will also have a facility at the base for training, aerial training, aerial awareness, skate parks, parkour, cheer facility, really all the lifestyle sports that we enjoy across the Powder portfolio. And so it brings together both this kind of urban mountain model that is for day use, but it'll also be a summer camp as well.
All right. So what did you say in terms of the construction timeline?
So it looks like we're hoping to break ground here in the next couple of months with opening summer of 2019.
Oh, so just a year, huh?
Yes, it's an aggressive target, but yeah. that's what we're shooting for.
Yeah, and then with John stepping down just because he's got other duties, is that a result of his dance passing or just taking on more there?
In part, John's always had a lot of outside responsibilities with the Crimson Wine Group, the foundations that he runs, and now with his dad's passing, the American Investment Company, he's now chairman of that as well. And so it was a real combination between Powder having a lot going on, a lot of great projects underway, and needing a lot of focus and attention, and John's responsibilities pulling him in other directions. And so he's still going to be a big part of the business, setting the vision, setting the strategy. John's been an amazing leader, and the values of Powder are something that we really hope to continue as the last standing independent ski resort company in the industry. And we think that's incredibly important as the consolidation of the industry continues. You know, for us to be able to be a family-owned, independent company, we take that role really seriously because, you know, we like to think we're building this business for John's kids, right? And it takes a really different perspective when you look at the business that way.
Yeah. Well, congratulations to your promotion. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
It's Wade Martin and Justin Sibley, again, the new co-presidents of Powder Corp. You're